Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Greg Fell to the broadcast. Greg is the CIO of the Terex Corporation, which is the third largest manufacturer of heavy and light construction equipment. Terex employs 16,000 team members globally, with 50 manufacturing facilities around the globe. Prior to joining Terex, Greg spent nearly 16 years at Ford Motor Company, where he held various senior-level IT positions in the engineering and manufacturing organizations. Greg has a BA in philosophy and medical ethics from Michigan State University, and I recently caught up with Greg in his office in Westport, Connecticut. Our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 3, Project and Portfolio Management, as we discussed some of his governance practices for his global team, Principle 4, IT and Business Partnerships, as we discussed Greg's methods of engaging the business as he built the IT function from the ground up, as well as a variety of other topics. Well, Greg Fell, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Excellent. Well, Greg, I thought we might begin, for those who may be less familiar, with a description of Terex and your role in the organization.
Okay. Well, I'm the global CIO for Terex Corporation. Terex is one of those Fortune 500 companies that most people have never heard of. We're the third largest construction equipment company in the world, but we're not really a public name. Our products are used primarily by the construction industry, not really a commercial product that the public generally sees. But we're in multiple segments. We're in the crane segment. We're in the aerial work platform business, which is putting people up in heights. And our brand there is Genie, and those are probably products that people have seen around. If you go to an airport or any construction site, you'll probably see one of our blue lifts. We're also in the material processing business, so we make big rocks into small rocks, and that's actually a fairly complicated process to make small rocks. And we're number one in the mobile business in that field as well. And then we're in the construction field. We make construction equipment, typical, you know, dump trucks and articulated trucks, as well as backhoe loaders, that type of stuff. We have a small presence in that business. Our bigger businesses are the other ones that I mentioned, our cranes business and our aerial work platform business. We're a global company. We've got 50 plus manufacturing locations. We do manufacturing in probably 25 countries. We're really a distributed company. We make a lot of products for local markets, so we're not necessarily making products in one place to distribute other places. We're making products for those local markets in many cases. So, you know, all the continents are represented, I think, except for Antarctica for us. So it's an interesting business.
And can you talk a bit about your role as CIO?
Yeah, so I came to Terex 5 years ago. I came from a small company in Detroit called Ford Motor Company.
I've heard of them.
Yes, you know, came from obviously a Fortune 10 company, and came to Terex 5 years ago as the first CIO of the company. Before I came here, the company was run as a merger and acquisition company, as a holding company, essentially. Bought and sold a lot of the smaller companies that played in this space, and they decided about 6 years ago, before I came, that there were some efficiencies to be had by globalizing the company, by putting pieces together, aggregating your spend, you know, for steel. When I started here, we realized we actually use more steel than BMW. And so, but geez, how come we're paying more than BMW for steel? And it's because BMW buys steel in bulk, and we were buying it through a bunch of different businesses at 50 different locations. And so there's those types of economies of scale that existed. And they decided that becoming an operating company may help from a margin perspective. And so they looked at, well, what do we need to start an operating company? And they started from scratch. And when I hired in, there were just a very small number of people in the corporate function, basically the accountants and lawyers, and a couple senior executives to kind of oversee things. And that was it. No functions of a company existed. So, you know, when I started, there were no email systems, there were no computer networks, no intranet. It was, you know, basically run as a bunch of different companies. So, You know, we didn't know who worked in the company. We were plus or minus 1,000 people to know how many people worked at the company. And so those are the kind of things we focused our energies on first, is just getting some of the base infrastructure together, some of the, you know, the key things of let's get a network, you know, running so that we can communicate. Let's get an email system that's standardized so that we know who works here and how to communicate to them, get an Active Directory for authentication, that type of stuff. So those were the basics that we had to start with. And then once we got that in place, it was really looking at, you know, putting in an ERP system to get those economies of scale. So when you start thinking about how do you leverage the company to do supply chain advantage, you know, HR and accounting opportunities to consolidate, those are things that require computer systems. And so it was heavily driven by our ability to execute a computer strategy on their ability to put the company together. I mean, the two went hand in hand. They didn't think that they could do it without a computer system. And obviously, just doing a computer system doesn't do it either. So it really was a case of getting the business processes lined up. But then really fundamentally at the core of it was getting a computer system to standardize those processes.
That's great. I was fascinated, Greg, in preparing for this, discovering that, in fact, there was not an IT function before you came here. So the organization was growing so fast that the thought hadn't occurred, or perhaps they had slowed down to the point of establishing this. You come along, establish this role, and now actually it's risen in prominence to the point that on earnings calls, the accomplishments of IT are called out. It's quite a journey.
Yeah, I mean, it's important because, again, if you're trying to do business process reengineering and reengineer how you're going to do all those functions, it's critical that the IT systems are there to support those. And so for us, it's one of those things that our CEO is actively involved in. And just to give kind of some background, I think it's important for some of the listeners to even understand from a governance perspective. You know, that was one of the key things that we put in place, and really where I was trying to push the company very hard to make sure that we had a robust governance process so that the decisions made on these IT systems were the decisions for this entire company and not just this is the IT guys putting in a computer system. So we put a governance process in place very early with the chief operating officer, the chief financial officer, the CFO, and three of our segment presidents, as well as the head of our HR function. We met every week for 2 hours to go through the details of where we were going with this thing. That's the kind of details and the kind of commitment that we needed to really kind of pull this together. If you know, and I know for a lot of the folks that may be listening and CIOs, you know, thinking about this, I think that's critical to line up, making sure when you have these kind of projects early, before they can think twice about them, you say, this is the kind of commitment you guys have got to step up to. And me coming into this position from the outside, that's one of the things that I required in order for me to get this thing going. And obviously they were committed to it, so they've kept that going. So now 5 years later, we still meet every other week for 2 hours. And the CEO now comes to that meeting. So that's the kind of commitment that we've got in terms of trying to make sure that those business decisions are made quickly, efficiently, and that everyone's aligned to the decisions that need to be made. And I would say that's one of the critical success factors for anybody, is just making sure that the executives understand that that commitment is required to be successful.
That's really interesting, Greg. As I think about that, so this is an organization and executives who were not used to having detailed conversations with any frequency about IT.
Correct.
As you engage them on a very frequent basis, did you make sure that you were putting the terms of what you were discussing in business terms? Was there an education process as to what IT can do, what IT does do, these sorts of things?
Yeah, it's a good question. Actually, a little bit of both. So obviously, you need to structure some of it through their lens. But the reality is, when you're talking about meeting every other week and going through the details of the project, some of it's just educating them on things that most of the time executives wouldn't normally, you know, care about. But the reality of, you know, how much we pay for contracts to outsource this stuff, or how much we're going to, you know, pay for software or data warehouse strategy, those are the kind of things that generally get glossed over most times as not business focused enough and more IT focused. But the reality is, those are the things that we had to speak of as well. But we spent just as much time on how we were going to set up our legal entity strategy and what legal entities things would flow through, and how we would do consolidated purchasing or or from a shared service perspective, which things would fall into shared services. So we had a mix of both, so we didn't make it an IT meeting, but we didn't shy away from the fact of, hey, these are the decisions that have got to be made, and so we need some input on some of this stuff as well. So there was an education on their part of the complexities of this, and anyone that has gone through a big ERP project knows there are a lot of complexities. You know, we joke as CIOs that ERP stands for early retirement program, and given that I'm in my 40s, I didn't really want that to be the strategy here. So, you know, that was something that, you know, we tried to make sure that they understood the complexities and that most of these things fail if we don't pay attention to all the details like that.
That's great. Well, it speaks volumes to your ability to communicate those terms. That they've actually continued to meet, and in fact, now that ERP is in place, that they're continuing to meet to
right.
talk about IT.
Well, that's we're great. Still going on this. I mean, that's one of the important things with ERP. We've got this running in multiple countries. Mm-hmm. We're running this on a single instance, but like anyone who's done an ERP system, there is no end
right.
because there's always another site, another country, you know, another version or something. So
another acquisition that you're
another
making.
Acquisition. Yeah. So we don't consider ourselves done by any stretch.
Good point. Very good point. Well, switching gears a little bit, Greg, you came from the automotive industry, from Ford, as you mentioned earlier,
mm-hmm.
Where productivity is often measured in minutes and seconds.
That's
now,
right.
as you described Terex's business, naturally, some of the things like construction and aerial work platforms and cranes and so on, these are products that are built over a series of days, and therefore there's a longer cycle time at
yes.
a minimum.
Right.
The extent to which any IT department is a reflection of the business within which they operate, how has that led to differences from where you traditionally come
yeah.
from?
Yeah, that was one of the biggest things I had to kind of get grips in. I had a significant experience at Ford in the manufacturing as well as product development. And on the manufacturing side, as you said, we built engines at a rate of every 18 seconds an engine was built. A vehicle, an entire car, which people, you know, are amazed to think about it, every 60 seconds one rolls off the end of the line. That's an incredible pace to building those vehicles, and the only reason that you can come up and make millions of vehicles per year. Our products, we have some products that are the world's most complex products, you know, biggest products. Our twin boom crane takes about 12 months to come to market. So from inception to starting to cut what steel to delivered on site at the customer is 12 months. That's a very different cycle time than every 60 seconds. And so because of that, the processes, while they're still manufacturing and cutting steel and welding and that type of things, the approach is very different. In the automotive industry, a lot of robotics, a lot of automation, computer systems that would keep track of, did we lose a second here or there, that type of technology. In our business, much less of that technology here at Terex, because again, the cycle times are longer, and so the requirement to measure things down to the, you know, real-time second aren't really necessary. So it's a lot more using visual manufacturing processes, you know, which apply here. So the ability to apply technology at the lowest level is a little bit less than the automotive, where you're not really having program logic controllers that are going to measure robotic time. So it's more about the business processes, the flow of information, the supply chain, as well as, you know, the customer experience. And that's one of the things that's actually different here, and I've had to adjust a bit, is having gone from an automotive that works through a dealer network to a company that goes direct in many cases, again, is a very different process. And so, you know, we have to worry about those type of things as well here in terms of customer processes, processing credit cards, all those type of things that when you go directly to the public, you have to worry about, whereas if you're going through a dealer network, you don't have to worry about it. So some differences, but again, some similarities in terms of manufacturing. Engineering-wise, probably more similar. You're still making a product, engineering it, trying to take out costs, trying to take out weight. So those applications still apply here as well.
Yep. You mentioned that the organization has grown tremendously through acquisition. And you talked about some of the sorts of systems like email, intranet, now ERP and so on, which mm-hmm. are introduced to a company that's acquired.
Right.
Is there now kind of a game plan that IT has to engage the new IT department that has been brought in as part of the company that's been acquired?
Right. Both for acquisitions as well as divestitures, we have a game plan in terms of infrastructure to get them up very quickly. So the basics of getting a computer network, hooking the two local area networks together, together, making sure from an infrastructure standpoint that what we're buying is safe from a security and network perspective, and then getting them access to email and our internal documents is important. From an ERP perspective, we evaluate each of them differently. Mm-hmm. If they've got a standalone business that's running effectively, we may decide to leave them alone for a while and sort of migrate this over time. If they've got a very broken business, then we've got to move more quickly and come up with, you know, solutions. So we don't have a game plan that says we always do it this way. This is the way it's done. We're still evaluating those on a case-by-case basis. Part of it is because we've still got work to do internal to the company. When we get to 100% and everybody's on it and all the only thing that's left is the acquisitions, we'll probably move more quickly to just put them on right away, but right now we evaluate those on a case-by-case basis, and in some cases we stay on their legacy system for a while.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, of course, this is an international business with a global footprint, and mm-hmm. you've got IT resources that reflect that.
Right.
Can you talk a bit about how you govern that structure?
Yeah, we have a federated IT model, but it's a very strong federated model. So, you know, each of the segments has a IT leader. Those IT leaders report to me. So in that sense, they're sort of centralized if we think about it. But the folks that are at the sites are actually paid for by the local sites. So that's where it's federated. So the local folks at each of the locations report in on a solid line into IT and a dotted line into the local business, and they're paid for by the local business. That's where the federation comes in. But we still have governance over those, and they report in through the central IT leaders that report into me. So it's a hybrid. You know, I'm a big fan of having a check and balance. I don't think a completely centralized organization makes a lot of sense. I don't think a completely decentralized organization does either. So I think you need to find what's a good compromise so that you come to getting the local decisions to be made when they make sense, and then also, you know, what can be centralized. Having that balance between the two, I think, is important. In our case, we do a lot to make sure that the entire organization feels like one organization. So we have a global meeting once a year where we bring all the folks from the sites together, not every individual at those sites, but the leaders from each of those sites get together. And then we have a strong set of policies and procedures that govern how those sites need to run, and we have an audit process that audits against those on an annual basis to make sure that they're following those policies and procedures. And so that's our governance process of making sure they know what's in the box and what isn't in the box. And I would just give one piece of advice on that to the listeners that I found very effective, and that is we put together a formal set of policies and procedures of how we want things done at the site. In each of those policies and procedures, we put a deviation form, an exception form, which has a set of signatures required, so that if the local site does not feel this makes sense for them because of whatever reasons, they have a process to go get a deviation so that they're still following the process. The process just means do this deviation. And that's a very good process I've seen. Instead of mandating and dictating something that someone else looks at and goes, this doesn't make any sense because in Germany we have this law that says you can't do that. Fine, fill out a deviation form and you're now following the policy. And that's a nice way of giving and empowering the local sites to make a decision to say, I'm not going to follow this, but I'm going to tell you that I'm not following it. And in most cases, I have had very few of these exceptions where I've pushed back. So somebody said, you know, I'm not going to spend $1 million to upgrade the system to do 8-character passwords because the risk is low, and here's why. Okay, that might be a good reason. I agree. I sign off on it, and they're following the process then. But I don't have to then make the policy the lowest common denominator. I can still make it a strong policy with just those few exceptions being the rare exception.
That's great. And so, I assume also the fact that one needs to justify it and write out why it is
exactly.
Also weeds out perhaps some of the instances where people want not to follow the policy, but
right.
rather give real reasons for
right.
not doing so.
And because we have an audit process annually, then that's one of the things that we look at. If you're not following this, where's your exception form? Here it is. Okay, you're good on that one. And we move on. And it's been a very effective way of doing it and making the sites feel like they got some accountability, because they can, if they decide to not follow it, they've got a way of getting that approved.
That's great. And do you employ a program management office to roll up all the investments and to be able to investigate those?
Yeah, so we have a PMO, as most companies do. That was one of the first things that I put in. In fact, you know, given that the company was a holding company, I said, well, I need to hire a leader to run our PMO. And they said, what's a PMO? So, you know, I had to start, you know, at the beginning in terms of what's the, you know, advantages of having a program management office. But we put one in place. And again, that's where we put a lot of our processes, our standardization in terms of policies and procedures, as well as the details and sign-offs required for projects. So we've got to standardize, project form and methodology to, gate stuff through our systems, and we follow those for relatively small projects. And we've got a formalized PMO process all the way down to $25,000 projects. Now, the steps for a $25,000 project are very different than the $1 million projects, but at least we've documented this is how we want you to follow for these type of size projects.
That's wonderful. As a final question, Greg, I wanted to pick your brain as to technology trends that are particularly exciting for you as you look into the future, and from what you read and from your right. peers that you speak with, what are some of the things that you're particularly excited about?
Well, I am a technologist, so while, like any CIO, I spend most of my time on business issues and relationships with the C-suite and other key leaders in the business, you know, I am a technologist at heart. You know, I'm at home testing out the new Open Solaris or Linux versions and testing out the new technologies, whether it's iPads or whatever else. I would say the biggest thing that I see is that's becoming a scary thing for a CIO, and also an interesting thing, is just the effect of consumer devices in the workplace, particularly mobility. And so how that's changing dramatically over the last few years, and people thinking about how they can use some of these mobile applications to really transform their business. And everybody has an example of those, but really what we're seeing is just the proliferation of those type of examples in our businesses, whether it's iPad apps for sales guys or whether it's mobile approvals of applications. We're a very big BlackBerry user as well, and so trying to leverage some of those technologies. And again, the convergence of those consumer devices into our space. We are in the process of looking at our mobility strategy and considering basically allowing anyone that wants to turn their consumer device on to pull corporate data to put those on mobile devices. And as the CIO, it's a kind of a scary thing to go do. But the reality is, if you don't do it, they're doing it anyway. So it's a question of see new evil or, you know, come up with a policy to really understand what's really going on. And so I think that's, you know, really critical. We've been very progressive at this company in terms of not limiting websites. And so social media sites, things like that, Skype, we don't block those things within the company. We want to encourage people to take advantage of those technologies. And we're willing to offset some of that with, there are inherent risks in some of those, but we're not a bank. So, you know, the things that we do that are very secure and need to be secured, our information, our CAD information. Obviously, if we do credit card processing, we separate those and firewall those things off. But for the rest of the stuff, we kind of want to be a more open company. That's our philosophy. And so the mobility strategy is really one that people take personally, because, you know, they look at this and say, why can't I do XYZ? And we've decided here not to be the office of no.
That's great. Well, I think you articulated well both the kind of opportunity, but also those areas where an IT executive needs to be cautious in opening the organization up. And as you say, it's an inevitability, so it might as well have a strategy in place.
Right, exactly.
Well, good. Greg Fell, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT. It's been a great conversation. You've certainly shared some great perspectives that I'm sure all our listeners will appreciate.
Well, it was a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
Just listen to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information about these five principles and sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metisstrategy.com. And please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metisstrategy.com. Our editor is Chris Davis, and our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.